Most business podcasts today focus on the 1%, the nationally known larger-than-life personalities, entrepreneurs, and celebrities with interesting business stories. Business Exit Stories shares the stories of the other 99% of unheralded entrepreneurs that own successful companies in manufacturing, retail, logistics, telecommunications, construction, food service, and in every imaginable type of business in every state and city around the country. These are the stories told by the deal makers that facilitate exits. These are the mergers and acquisition specialists, business brokerages, financial and wealth planners, CPAs, appraisers, and attorneys. By listening to their stories, you'll learn what the entrepreneurs and business owners they represent did right and what they did wrong when it comes to exiting their business through a sale or a merger. In fact, you'll not only learn how they avoided disastrous exits, but how they positioned their companies for an out-of-the-ballpark home run when they exited their business. And here's your host, Marvin L. Storm.
Today we have with us Jim Burns. Jim is a mergers and acquisition attorney based in Arizona. The transactions he typically deals with are between $20 million and $40 million in deal value, but they can range from $5 to $100 million in value. Jim shares several transactions where there were some really interesting twists and turns. In one of the deals he was involved in, had an important takeaway for any seller of their company. He shares where a seller really didn't appreciate the leverage his president CEO held. This lack of awareness and unwillingness to incentivize this person to facilitate the sale of the business cost him $500,000 in an acquisition fee that he had to pay to his CEO to get the deal closed. All of this could have been avoided with some recognition and a small payment earlier in the deal. In another transaction, a legal secretary at the closing meeting noticed an irregularity on the closing documents regarding the selling company's corporate name. Come to find out, the controller of the company had allowed the corporate status to lapse with the Secretary of State 5 years earlier and had attempted to cover up his mistake. This cover-up nearly cost the deal to fall apart. In another transaction, a corporate stock certificate in a stock sale representing a 45% ownership of the company couldn't be located in a $39 million transaction. You'll learn how this lost stock certificate, if it ever existed at all, could have ended up costing the business owner tens of millions of dollars, and you'll learn what happened to avoid this. This is Marvin L. Storm with the Business Exit Stories podcast. Today we're here with Jim Burns. Jim is an M&A attorney based out of Phoenix. Jim, would you take a few minutes and introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your background?
Sure. Good morning. My name is Jim Burns. I'm an M&A attorney in Phoenix, Arizona with the law firm of Carson Messenger, PLLC. Carson Messenger is an old Phoenix law firm formed in 1924 when Arizona was still a territory. It's a boutique, mid-sized to small firm specializing in business transactions, business representation of business owners. So we basically will do anything from business setup, joint venture agreements, articles of incorporation, and operating agreements, employment agreements, you know, litigation if need be, M&A, obviously, real estate matters for our business owners, and then certain personal things for business owners, such as, you know, estate planning and things of that nature. Currently, we have 7 attorneys. I've been with the firm since 1984, 35 years. During that time, we've probably been somewhere between 6 and 15 attorneys most of my career. So it's always been a boutique specialized law firm.
And on the M&A side, when you have both buyers and sellers, what percentage of your transactions that you get involved in are on the either buyer or seller side?
For my particular practice, we've sort of developed a niche representing sellers. I would say probably 85% of my transactions are representing the seller of a business. That sort of came about a little bit by, I can't say that I set out to fill that niche or anything like that, but it just sort of developed that way. Like I said, I've been doing this for 35 years. And, you know, as time went on, I just kind of developed a network of former clients and M&A advisors. And so the practice just sort of naturally evolved into a seller heavy M&A practice. It's also, candidly, most of the buyers, they fall into one of three groups. They're either a local competitor, or they're a professional buyer, such as a private equity fund or a strategic buyer that's, you know, looking to expand their business through acquisition. Those type professional equity, equity funds, private equity funds, and strategic buyers have a tendency to be represented by large national firms because they're typically buying companies all over the country. So it's a firm our size is better suited to focus on seller representation.
All right. So you mentioned that a lot of the acquiring companies that you deal with are larger private equity funds or strategic buyers of some sort or another. What amount of the transactions then do you actually deal with in Arizona? And how is your deal flow spread out over a number of states? Is it all in the Southwest or all over the country?
It's mainly in the Southwest. The way these transactions work typically is the buyer is going to generate the first draft of the acquisition documents in virtually every case, probably 99.9% of the cases. And they're going to have their say of the choice of law. And it's typically wherever they're based. Some people go Delaware just because Delaware's, you know, considered a business-friendly, neutral state. But if it's not Delaware, it's typically going to be where they're based. So we end up representing sellers from Texas to Arizona, California, Utah, Nevada, Idaho, Washington. The majority would be just because of the population would be in Arizona and California. But like I said, pretty much anywhere in the Southwest. And if we need local counsel, because typically what will happen is, you know, my client will be based in San Diego and the company that's buying them is based in Atlanta and they pick Georgia law. So if we need to get a Georgia attorney on some discrete issue, you know, we have relationships with people. Surprisingly, it doesn't come up all that much. Mostly this is just basic contract law and it's typically governed by the same throughout the country.
So since your specialty is M&A law and practice, give me an idea of the type of transactions you do and the size of the transactions you do and where most of your deals fall as far as an average transaction size.
Sure. So our specialty is what is referred to in the industry as mid-market deals, and that's basically $5 million to $100 million. We certainly are going to do the occasional deal less than $5 million, and that would typically be a local company selling to a competitor. Not always, but typically that's what that is. Most of our deals are going to fall within the $20 to $40 million range. We're going to do an occasional bigger deal in the $70, $80, $90 million range. But the vast majority of them would fall in that, 28, 29, 39, 43 million dollar range.
What's your average client profile? Are they larger companies, closely held family businesses? What's kind of the profile of a client?
I would say our typical profile is a family business. I would say it kind of falls into two camps. I would say probably 60, 70% are a family business, and that can be just a husband and wife and sometimes kids, grown kids. Or it can be siblings that seems to come up quite a bit where, you have two or three brothers or, two brothers and a sister that own a company that they often in that case have inherited from their parents. And then the other maybe 30, 40% would be closely held, just individuals who got together somewhere down the road and started a business. That would be the vast majority of our clients.
Since most of your buyers are professional buyers, as you said, private equity firms, and private equity firms often leverage their transactions. How often are the transactions cash or a combination of cash and debt?
I would say most of the transactions that we see are cash. Now, there may be a financing component that is behind the scenes that we're not involved in. Sometimes these private equity groups will have both an equity fund and a debt fund, and they will do some combination of debt and equity on the acquisition. Having said that, a deal I'm currently working on this morning, does have a straight third-party financing contingency. I would say that's not common. I mean, I might see one or two of those every 3 or 4 years. The vast majority of them, they either have the financing piece already in place, like a strategic buyer may have a large line of credit that they're using to acquire companies, you know, across the country, or a private equity group may have a debt fund that they dip into, and they do a combination of debt and equity. But it's not often that it's a deal contingency like the one I'm working on today.
All right. Well, why don't we move over to some of the deal transactions you've been involved in, and maybe some of them that didn't go all that well. Could you share a transaction for us that had some challenges to it?
Sure. One that I'll always remember involved a medical billing company in the Southwest. And the way that company was structured wasn't quite absentee ownership, but it wasn't day-to-day involvement by the owner. The owner of the company basically came in early in the morning before anybody else arrived, and he checked the results from yesterday's operations. And then he left for the day, and he had a third-party president CEO who just basically ran the company on his behalf. So, you know, it wouldn't be fair to call him a completely passive investor, but he was very passive from the standpoint of he didn't get down in the weeds and wasn't there day to day. His role was really more strategic planning and big picture items. So he sold that company to a private equity fund. And private equity funds typically do not have management in place that they want to use. You don't need two presidents, but typically they want to leave management in place. So in this particular case, it was very important to the buyer that management remain in place, particularly the person who had actually ran the business day to day for the last several years. So with that in mind, the investment advisor for my client had recommended that we incentivize the president with an acquisition bonus. And I seconded that theory so that A, he would cooperate, and B, he would sign an employment agreement with the new buyer, because this was structured as an asset sale. So, you know, it would be necessary for him to sign an employment agreement with the new buyer. They couldn't just assume the existing contract since they weren't buying the company itself, but just substantially all its assets. My client balked at that.
Why would he balk at that?
He kind of felt like that the president wasn't an owner, hadn't taken any ownership risk, and was highly compensated. And so, I mean, I hate to say it, but I think he felt like he should be happy that the new company wants to continue his employment. I believe his salary was, or compensation package, and this is probably 15 years ago, is probably in the $250,000 a year range. So he just felt like, you know, he's not an owner. He didn't deserve any piece of the pie. In hindsight, I wish we'd have pressed him a little harder. I mean, we pressed him a little bit, but he felt like, you know, I've known this guy a long time. He'll play ball. He understands my, you know, that I want out, and I want to take my chips off the table and create a liquidity event. But that's not the way it worked out. What basically happened was, you know, obviously I had to advise him to get his own counsel to negotiate his employment agreement with the new buyer, because, you know, I had a conflict of interest representing the owner. And he did that, and we went on down the road and got all the acquisition documents finally fully negotiated and pointing towards the closing, which was going to happen in this particular case in Texas. And this was a little bit before people got used to the idea of doing electronic closing. So, you know, we all flew down to Texas for the closing. Back in the day, you typically close in a large conference room at a law firm, and they'd have all the documents set out on the table. Lawyers and assistants running around making sure everything's fully signed and executed, and then they would launch the lawyer, and everybody would celebrate. That was the plan. We got there and we signed everything up, but the president never showed up for the closing, and, you know, got to be unfortunately pretty obvious that he wasn't going to show up. So we all said we'd regroup tomorrow, and my client would hopefully track him down and find out what was going on. At that point, he advised everybody that he was not willing to sign his employment agreement without a significant payment, probably 4 to 5 times what we had suggested that our client offer him as an acquisition fee at the outset. And I think at that point, it has been pretty clear to him that there was no deal without him staying on board. So we flew home without a closing, and it took about 2.5-3 months, as I recall, to finally negotiate the a price that he would accept and convince the buyer that he was fully on board.
So what was the size of this transaction on the sales side?
My recollection was it was in that $15 or $20 million range. It was a significant transaction.
So we have a situation here where an owner who's selling his business $15 million has a CEO that's running the business on a day-to-day operating basis. And he comes in the morning and kind of checks things at the end of the day. And he has this person that's really key to his operation of the business. And a private equity company is coming in to buy the business and wants that management agreement in place, that employment agreement in place. And the key person figured out that this deal isn't happening without him. So he was really pivotal to the transaction.
Exactly. He was basically the kingmaker, as we called him. Without his signature, we weren't closing. And it was also awkward because he had to both continue working with him day to day during this post-closing period and convince him to sign his agreement. And it ended up costing my guy close to $500,000.
So he could have written a check for $100,000 and paid an acquisition fee, but it ended up costing him $500,000 a few months later.
Exactly. I have, by the way, I've used that story, kind of once bit, twice shy type thing. But I do from time to time see some pushback from some of my seller clients for the same reasons, which is, they've taken no ownership risk. They get handsomely compensated. They should be happy they're going to continue to have a position with the new company, et cetera. I just think it's an insurance policy. If you know you need somebody, now this was an extreme case. My client literally didn't do any day-to-day work. That's not the typical situation that I encounter. But in this particular case, he didn't. And there are oftentimes in companies I've come to find one or two people that may be key to the acquisition. It's more common with private equity group buyers because they typically don't have management. So you just have to be, you have to be aware of that type of situation and be honest with yourself about if you were buying the company, would you buy it without, Jane or Joe? And if not, I would give serious thought to give them some incentive.
Well, that's a good takeaway.
The other thing to keep in mind is it can work if they're not going to retain management. But you need that person to make the sale go through, just from the standpoint of due diligence, continuing to operate the company until you've gotten your money. Because if I'm the president of your company and we're selling to Apple, and I know Apple has all their own managers and they don't need me, I'm going to start looking for a job immediately. So we oftentimes in those situations also suggest a retention bonus that you'll stay through the closing and pay usually about a year's salary.
All right. Well, I appreciate you sharing that. And those are some good takeaways, both the retention bonus and an acquisition fee, money well spent in many situations. Can you share a little bit about another deal, perhaps focusing a little bit on due diligence and how due diligence is really crucial to making a transaction flow?
Sure. So typically, like I said, we typically deal with most of the time with what I call professional buyers. They have a process and procedures that they go through. And once the letter of intent signed and while we're negotiating the acquisition documents on a parallel path, we're going down the due diligence pathway. And usually when they generate the letter of intent and the offer and acceptance, all they've done is look at your financial statements. They obviously know what you do or they, what your business is and have an interest in buying you, and they've confirmed that your financials are what they hope they would be, and that's what they priced the deal off of. But now they've got to go in and kind of kick the tires and open the hood and look underneath the hood and check everything out. A lot of times they'll bring in their own due diligence team. Often it's a Pricewaterhouse or a BDO or something like that. And what I always tell my clients is to remember that these people are getting paid to find issues. If they, generate a 50-page due diligence report and charge their client $50,000 for it and say everything looks great, it kind of looks like maybe they didn't earn their money. It's almost like, it's gotten popular to do these home inspections when you sell a house and they bring in a home inspection company. They're going to come in and say, this socket doesn't work or that doesn't, this light bulb burn out. They try to find problems. That's what they're getting paid for. So it's very, very important to have kind of all your ducks in a row and things that maybe if you were going to keep the company wouldn't be that important to you. Just think about somebody who doesn't own your company and doesn't have the history and background that you do, and whether it'll be important really to their lawyers and accountants. So a couple different situations I've had come up where that's really, really caused a problem. On one, I was on the buy side, which is not usual for me, but I was in this case, and we were buying a trucking company, and they probably had 200 titled vehicles, you know, basically large trucks. Again, this is back when everybody went in person, and we got to the closing, and we actually had signed all the documents, and we're just about ready to celebrate and crack the champagne. And my legal assistant had noticed that in the documents from the Corporation Commission, evidencing that the company was in good standing, the name was slightly different than what was reflected on all the documents and all the title certificates of title for the trucks. And I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was something minor like Acme Trucking Inc. versus Acme Trucking Romanet 2 Inc. And so we asked about that. Well, wait a minute, did we do the documents wrong? Do we have the name wrong, you know, for all these months? And the lawyer's like, no, I don't think so. I represented this company for a long time. We put everything on hold just to confirm whether we had to reprint and resign everything. And what it turned out had happened was the controller of the company, of the seller, had failed to file their annual report with the Corporation Commission, had not responded to the two or three notices of delinquency that are generated, and the Corporation Commission had revoked the charter, which the corporation no longer exists. And basically, for no other way of putting it, to cover up his mistake, he reincorporated the company with a name as similar as the Corporation Commission would approve, which is why it had a Romanet 2 after the name. So the legal effect of that was the company whose assets we thought we were buying hadn't existed for 5 years, and a new company owned all those assets, which may not have been as big an issue in some businesses as others, but when you have 200 title vehicles, it's a huge issue. We had to put the closing on hold. They had to go down and get all the vehicles, and then they had to transfer those titles to us as the buyer. So anybody who's ever dealt with the DMV in their state will understand how much fun that was, going down and trying to explain what happened to the DMV and then retitling 200 vehicles and turning around and immediately retitling them back to us as the buyer. So little things that may not seem that important if you're not selling the company can be very important if you're selling the company. Another situation I had actually recently was two brothers were selling the company. They've been in their family since the early 60s. And they were getting, you know, the $39 million transaction. So they were, you know, it was a big deal, whether it was BDO or Pricewaterhouse or something like that, I don't remember. But at one point, they casually mentioned that the stock certificates, this was a stock sale, the stock certificates showed John Doe owned 45% of the company back when it was formed in 1961. And can we dig up his stock certificate showing that it had been transferred to the other family members and he no longer had an interest in the company? And this company was based in the Southwest and Northwest, actually. And I said, hey, you got to dig up that old stock certificate. It didn't seem like a big deal at the time. We had other, you know, bigger issues on the table and trying to get the transaction done. And, you know, about every 10 days to 2 weeks, you know, a revised checklist would come out and, you know, the stock certificate would always appear on it and I'd ask them about it. Well, when we came just a couple days out from the closing, I said, hey, I got to have that stock certificate. And they couldn't find it. And they had, you know, no idea what happened. But, you know, as I recall, the guy said I was 9 years old, you know, when my dad took over the company. I don't really remember what happened. Obviously, I wasn't privy to what was going on, but his mom was still alive. And his mom recalled that her husband, her father, had given his partner a speedboat for his 45% of what then was a very small company. It was a handshake deal. These guys were business partners and friends. You know, they didn't go to the lawyer and have it documented in any way. So here we are 50 years later selling the company, and there's an outstanding stock certificate for 45% of the shares. To somebody who's long since deceased and no longer around and hasn't been involved in the company in, you know, 51 years. Fortunately, we were able to, you know, work around that for that very reason, that the company was so old, it happened so long ago. Mom remembered what happened, and she was able to sign an affidavit to that effect. And we got the buyer comfortable that, you know, you've looked at 50 years of records. This guy's name never appears after 1968 when all this happened. and they were comfortable enough to go forward.
So in this situation, when you have the situation where the stock certificate couldn't be produced, in theory, the original partner still retained those shares because there was no stock certificate to transfer those shares in existence. So in theory, this could have been a very big deal.
A very big deal, and particularly because, I mean, there was no like, oh, here's a check stub from the company, or we can go back and, you know, that, you know, I don't know if anyone would keep that stuff for 50 years, but there was no real way to evidence that he was ever bought out. So oftentimes I have clients come to me and say, I can't find my stock certificates. I started this company in 1981, and I mean, you know, we moved 16 times and there was a flood. It's no problem. There's a statutory procedure to just sign an affidavit of loss certificate and issue a new certificate. But this was actually a third party that owned a piece of the company and was long since deceased, and, you know, would have never been able to find them. So, like I said, fortunately, the buyer was pragmatic, said, look, there, you know, we've done exhaustive diligence, and this person's name hasn't appeared in 50 years on any corporate records or minutes or annual reports. You know, we're comfortable taking the affidavit that he was in fact bought out, you know, 51 years ago.
But this was a substantial sale. I think you said it was the $39 million transaction, right?
Correct. There were some tense moments for about 48 hours. So they got back to us and said they'd take the affidavit because there was no other solution. I mean, I suppose we could have skipped traced his errors. But the problem with that is, you know, when you go to somebody that knows nothing about what you're talking about and says, you know, your great-grandfather owned an interest in a company back in the 60s that he sold for a speedboat, and I need you to sign a waiver, they want money usually.
Yeah, $39 million waiver. That's one expensive speedboat.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, those type of problems need to be addressed early on. And like I said, a lot of people just were like, well, you know, it was my company. I ran it. Nobody ever raised any questions, but everything is an issue when you're selling your company and you have somebody whose job is to find problems looking under the hood.
Do you find dealing with larger private equity firms that they generally have the due diligence people and that they are professional enough to work through these type of issues and have some level of understanding that they've been through this a number of times before since they do this for a living, that they are pretty well equipped to deal with these type of issues versus a buyer that's buying it for the first time and doesn't deal in these level of transactions before?
In part, I think private equity groups are more, are better able to work through practical issues like the one we just talked about. As they always have investors and they have financial issues on the financial statement, they are very sticklers on. So they're not going to be practical if you have $500,000 of obsolete inventory that you haven't reserved for or haven't shown on your financial statement and have included in your line item for inventory. Those type of things, they're not practical at all. But on issues like lost stock certificate or, you know, more day-to-day operational issues, they do seem to be a little bit more accustomed to those type things, knowing that they're buying a privately held business.
Well, Jim, why don't we move over and chat a little bit about a transaction that went very smooth and maybe some company that you've dealt with that had a lot of due diligence put together where they were able to facilitate the quick closing.
Okay. I had that experience in at the end of 2017, I got a call from a client that was selling their business. Guys had gotten together and formed they service basically the home building industry. They provide finished services like countertops, cabinets, carpet, paint, stuff like that. They had been working with a wealth advisor / investment advisor for about 3 years prior to them contacting me. And they had been pointing towards selling the company. Like I said, they were business associates. They weren't family members. They were all in a different place in their life. You know, some were married, some were single, some had grown kids, some had young kids, and they wanted to kind of cash out and, you know, kind of create a liquidity event and do different things, you know, with their life at that point. Since they had been pointing towards this and it had, you know, kind of professional advisors at that point, they had completely cleaned up all their financial statements. There was no, you know, bad debt on the books. There was no obsolete inventory. Or if any of those things did occur, they were properly reserved for. Their statements were strictly in accordance with GAAP. Their company wasn't that old. It wasn't one of these 50-year-old companies like we talked about. It was maybe 10 or 15 years old. But, you know, they had all their documents, you know, readily available. All their corporate records were up to date. And so when they called me right around Thanksgiving and said that we want to close by the end of the year. That just seemed, in all candor, almost an impossible task. I mean, you have people gone for the holidays, and typically these transactions take 60 to 90 days start to finish, and, you know, we're talking now 5 weeks to get it done. But because they also had a very motivated buyer. The buyer was in the industry.
What type of buyer? Was it a financial buyer or strategic buyer?
Strategic buyer. They're growing their company by acquiring bolt-on acquisitions, basically. So they had bought several companies, and they had a team in place, and they had documents in place. They generated the first draft of the acquisition documents within, you know, 5 days. And they always say this, but they actually did. You know, we use a football reference and say, you know, did you start with the documents on the 50, or are you going to make me drive the length of the field and, you know, change every paragraph and put reasonable in 500 times? And they really started kind of on the 50, given the time frame we had. And so we were able to move through that process relatively quickly and get that transaction done in half the amount of time it normally takes, just because these type of issues that always seem to come up had already been addressed. We did have a motivated buyer, though. So, I mean, that helps as well. I mean, part of it's luck, but part of it is because these guys were prepared to sell the company and had answers for everything when it came up. They didn't have to go, well, let me get back to you. And, of course, when people ask you for things, and you're running your company during all this, it's not like you get to go on a sabbatical to, quote-unquote, sell the business. Most people are there running it day-to-day, doing this stuff at night and on weekends. Find those old stock certificates, and they don't have 24 hours a day to look for them. They look for them at night or on the weekend when they think about it. And, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks can go by with nothing getting done. But, you know, in this particular case, since they were pretty much all ready to go and motivated to sell and had been pointing towards this potential sale, they had almost everything readily available, and there were no significant delays at all.
So in this case, a wealth advisor, financial planner, worked with each of the four principals of the company that obviously had settled on their own planning that they wanted to exit several years in advance. They took the time to sit down with their advisor and work through all of the potential issues that were going to come up in due diligence. Whether it was financial statements or the inventory or documentation that was going to be needed in the closing process, everything they had together, they got cleaned up, they got their due diligence book, their data book all ready to go, and then went to market. It sounds like they went to market in fourth quarter, and then this strategic buyer surfaced that had his own timeline, as I understand that, as you went through the details of the transaction, is that they wanted to close by the end of the year. It wasn't really the seller that needed to close by the end of the year, but the buyer that was motivated to close. Is that right?
That's correct. You know, way back in the day, probably 25 years ago when I was doing these deals, there were all kinds of tax reasons why the deals had to close by year end. And you could get accelerated depreciation, 2-for-1 write-offs and things like that. But those loopholes have all been closed. So there's no real legal or tax reason to have to close by year end. The buyer wanted to be able to reflect the results of operations of this company in their financial statements from Jan 1/18. So they were motivated to close by year end, and we did. I think we closed on the 28th or 29th of December.
Well, that's unusual. As you said, it takes time for all the documentation to be verified and all the due diligence to be put together, and there'd be no way in a normal situation, if the buyers had come to the table, as many buyers come to the table or the sellers come to the table with a incomplete due diligence package, and a professional strategic buyer like this is going to have the requirements and a list of checkoffs that they need to verify, this could not have closed by year end under normal circumstances with a traditional type of due diligence package that's incomplete.
Not a chance. I mean, 5 weeks is just incredibly fast for these type deals. I mean, I always tell people 60 to 90 days. That seems to be about right. And when they go past 90, that typically means there's been some sort of issue that's popped up that has to be dealt with. the documentation itself, the acquisition documents, they typically go back and forth 6 to 10 times between the lawyers. I mean, obviously, we're trying to protect two different things. You know, I'm representing the seller, so I'm going to basically just say, look, you hired BDO, you're paying them $200,000. They can come in and look under the hood all they want. You don't need a bunch of representations from me, so you can, you know, come back and sue me a year later when you didn't, you know, make your 18% internal rate of return that you expected. And of course, the buyer on the other side is saying, I'm paying you $39 million for a clean company. I don't expect to have problems, to have obsolete inventory, a major piece of equipment that you knew that you had rigged up with duct tape so it would keep, you know, running and you didn't have to do a major repair. I don't expect it to break in 2 months and I got to spend $300,000 to fix it. You do that saber dance back and forth. And most people's due diligence packages just aren't complete. They just had no reason that, you know, they own the company. They don't need to pull all this stuff together. So yes, that's very well put.
Well, Jim, if you had to give any advice, since you represent sellers most of the time, if you had to give a seller, a new client, any advice in getting ready to sell their company, what's one specific piece of advice that you feel would be most beneficial to them?
The first I would focus on if I were selling my company is to make sure my financial statements are clean. What I see, you know, all too often is we've got the purchase price negotiated, we think. We get all the documents negotiated and the due diligence is done. And then the third quarter comes out and they missed their number by a mile because there was some charge that they knew or should have known was coming down the pike. And they try to retrade the price. You've already in your mind sold the company. You've paid your accountant or you got a whole bunch of money to your accountants and attorneys. And, you know, something comes up on the financial statements you probably could have addressed going in had you, you know, taken the time to do so. So that would be the first thing I would do. A lot of these other due diligence things, you know, if you have the time, like these guys on this construction company, they had a strategic plan to sell the company in 3 years. And so they, you know, they still ran their business and they still, you know, worked a full work week, but they were focusing on, hey, 2 years now we're going to sell, and they would clean stuff up as it came along. And that's the main thing. Unless you're selling to a local competitor that's just buying you based on your reputation and because they know your business, people have to remember that these buyers don't know your business from Adam. They certainly don't know it like you do, and they're going to be basing it on hard evidence they can look at, financial statements, you know, things of that nature.
Well, advice well positioned, I think, for sellers out there. Jim, if someone wanted to reach out to you after listening to this podcast and chat with you, how would they do that?
The name of the firm is Carson Messenger, PLLC, or they can shoot me an email and I'd be happy to talk to them. I talk to people at various stages of this process all the time.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time. You know, you have a little bit different orientation than a deal maker that is working on the transaction. You sit on the other side of the table as an attorney advising and putting all the documentation and details together to make sure these transactions can get across the closing line. So I appreciate you taking a few minutes here today and sharing your experience and some of the transactions you've dealt with over the years.
I appreciate it. Enjoy talking to you.
Join us in our next episode when our guests will share more stories of how entrepreneurs, founders, and business owners have exited their businesses and learn about what to avoid and what you need to do to successfully position your business for a successful exit. If you enjoyed this podcast, take a minute to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts so aspiring entrepreneurs everywhere can find us. If you wish to reach out to any of our guests, please visit our website at www.businessexitstories.com where you can find more information. Join us next time for more Business Exit Stories.